All right. Well, a strategy to rebuild the union movement is a bit of a big ask, especially when you've only got, what, sort of 30-odd people in the room. So, yeah, we'll see how we go. But to start with, I guess to outline the nature of the problem, there's obviously some rebuilding that needs to be done, and you can look at this in a whole number of ways. One that was highlighted last year in a study by the Australia Institute is the issue of unpaid overtime. About half of all workers in Australia who are white-collar workers are required to work some sort of extra work that they don't get paid for. About a quarter of all blue-collar workers are in the same situation. And according to this study by the Australia Institute, the average amount for the average full-time worker, the average amount of unpaid overtime that we do is 70 minutes every day. Now, you add that up, as they did, and you get to 33 8-hour days across a year. About six and a half full-time working weeks is what the average worker is working totally for free for the bosses in Australia right now today. And so more than what we get in annual leave, if we're lucky enough to get annual leave, and a quarter of people in Australia who are workers don't have any entitlements to leave whatsoever because they're casual, even if we get annual leave, it's usually 4 weeks, we give more than that back to the boss every single year. In terms of general living conditions, it's hard to get comparative statistics, but there were articles around last year saying that Australia was the gold medal winner for the least affordable housing in the entire Western world, which would explain why Australia is definitely the gold medal winner for the highest level of personal debt on the entire planet. Last year, we finally got past America, the former home of, the former medal winner. So this is the good times. This is the best that capitalism has to offer in the 21st century. We are the country that our government trumpets that, we've sort of dodged the bullets so far, supposedly, we're told, of the global financial crisis. And this is the good times. And we seem to be, loading ourselves up with debt, slaving our life away, just to get a bit of security in our old age. I work on building sites. A lot of the people I work with have uncles or grandparents or, relatives of some sort over in Europe, in countries like Portugal, Germany, Greece and so on, Italy. And they talk about the pension systems that they have over there, that if you work, for most of your life, you end up with a pension equivalent to 70%, in some cases even 90% of the wage that you finish on. We don't have anything similar to that here in Australia at all. So it's no surprise that a 2005 study by Unions New South Wales found that some 70% of us are extremely concerned about our security, income security in old age. A lot of the conditions that the workers in Greece and the rest of Europe are fighting to maintain are conditions that have been stripped off us, basically over the last 20 years. So even just in terms of, the bread and butter stuff that unions, can and should be, mobilising people about, we have a hell of a long way to go, a lot of rebuilding to do. Of course, it's not just the immediate economic conditions and working class living standards that unions have taken up in their long history in Australia. Any revival of the union movement would be an enormous boost to every social movement that you can think of. And in the past, just one union I'll be talking about a bit later, the Waterfront Workers Union, or the MUA today, Maritime Union of Australia, has taken action. They banned pig iron from going to Japan to make munitions to bomb China in the 1930s. They banned barbed wire going to Vietnam for the war effort in the early 1960s. They took action in support of Aboriginal rights. They took action against uranium mining. A whole range of things. Obviously a whole range of social causes are obviously given enormous backing by the union movement. So such movements would also benefit from such a revival. And on a more fundamental level, like the experience of being able to tell your boss to go jump, we're not working in that way, we're not working at all perhaps, can be a life-changing experience. It can really open people up to the idea that the way things are is not the way that they have to be. That, the boss and their entire class doesn't have to rule every aspect of our lives, that we don't have to accept just what we're given. It can be an enormously powerful thing. For that reason, Engels, Marx's lifelong collaborator, described unions as, said, as schools of war, the unions are unexcelled. So as schools of war, though, the unions are actually in pretty poor repair. And this is, I won't show you much of this depressing chart, but it is important to get a bit of an idea of it. this is, if you think you're saying double, it's because you are. I'm no master of Excel, but the general shape, you've got 1940 here, and thanks to Tom for supplying the figures for me to stuff up in Excel. You've got 1997 here, and this is basically days lost, supposedly, in industrial action per 1,000 workers over that time. So you can see an immediate surge in the closing years of World War II. And after World War II, the long dark years of Menzies in the 50s and coming into the 60s, a massive union revival that I'll be talking about in a sec, the peaks with the wage militancy in 1974, where for every 1,000 workers, more than 1,200 days were lost in industrial action. Thank you. If that's the sort of high point, 1,200 days lost per 1,000 workers, we're at the low point up here, just past 1997. The figure for 1997 was, I think, 9 days per 1,000 workers lost in industrial action. So we've come down a hell of a long way. So much for the urgent need for revival. I'll be talking through a bit of that history in a sec. But the strategy part is actually, the really difficult part. We can all agree that we need a revival. But a strategy, to say that you have a strategy, implies that you have the forces to actually carry it out. And different times in the past, people have had a strategy that they've put into operation and it's borne some fruit. In the early 1920s, the Communist Party in America saw, the class struggle is at an ebb. The workers' organisations are being smashed. There's a whole lot of frame-ups. The forces of the new Communist Party were extremely small, limited overwhelmingly to the clothing trades in New York. So what they did, rather than attempt to put themselves at the head of every struggle, they focused on frame-ups of workers who had been involved in industrial action. That meant that they could still talk about working-class power, they could still talk about a strategy for the unions, they could reach out to a whole variety of workers who were also fighting defensive battles and so on. It was a way to build their influence, build their strength, and build the influence and strength more generally of the union movement, and was very effective in doing that. The Communist Party here in the 30s, there'll be a talk given tomorrow by Liam Ward about the massive revival led by, in many cases, by the Communist Party when unions were recovering from the depths of the Depression in the 1930s. Without wanting to steal all of his thunder, part of it was the Communist Party recruiting people and winning people to a worldview of a world free from capitalism in the great struggles of the 1930s on unemployed issues, especially around eviction struggles. From that, they found when employment picked up, all of a sudden they had these class-conscious militants who were, trained in some sort of struggle, had a bit of get-up-and-go, going into industries such as coal mining, the timber workers, and so on, and were able to work out a strategy from there to take the unions forward. But again, we don't have those sorts of forces. We're not in that sort of crisis. And that sort of strategy really, isn't appropriate. So basically, if you're rocking up expecting that I'd have it all sort of chiseled out on stone tablets, here's the strategy, take it away at the door, off we go, let's revive. Unfortunately, you're going to be extremely disappointed. I think it's possible to make some general points about, strategic sort of orientation, some general points that we need to keep in mind when we're talking about reviving the union movements and perhaps talk about some of the possibilities. But in terms of our strategy that we can take out of here and put into operation, I really don't think there is one. Okay. When you look at this depressing graph that I showed before, one of the arguments that sort of comes up is just how, well, maybe everything's changed. Maybe we just can't do it anymore. Maybe the working class has missed, its historic chance and, that graph will continue to go down and there's nothing much we can do about it. And, I don't want to spend a lot of time on that. People can raise it in the discussion. But it is worth saying that this idea that the working class is finished and it's all kaput and let's give up has been around for an awfully long time. Every time that we, struggle, history doesn't move in a straight line, History moves in fits and starts and with long pauses and so on. Every time there's a long pause, a long downturn in the class struggle, you get people coming saying, oh, the working class is finished. The earliest, that I can remember, quote from some such figure saying this sort of thing was, I think, from 1863, where it was a fellow in Britain talking about, oh, it's not the same as the 1840s, where the workers were all poor and they all used to stand around talking about, the great principles of democracy and unionism and so on. Really now, they've all got shares in co-ops, they all dress cooperatively and they're not interested in the revolution at all. Well, you know, the 1860s was a time of serious downturn in the class struggle in Britain. But that didn't stop a major revival happening at the end of the 1880s with some massive strikes giving birth to a whole range of new unions and a series of revivals since then. So, yeah, so it is worth bearing in mind that these things have been said before. It's also worth bearing in mind, once you start listening for the phrase, no, we never had much to do with each other, you know, before the struggle, it's amazing how often it pops up. Because that's one of the things too, people say, oh, well, we're more privatised, we're more suburbanised, we're more atomised, we don't have the same sort of cohesion as workers that perhaps we used to. Well, a hell of a lot of workers have lived in, you know, very atomised, thank you, atomised competitive sort of situations, and it's actually the struggle that starts to bring them together as a class. And, you know, you can see documentaries about, you know, French textile workers in 1967. I remember seeing one, you know, it's a whole little, you know, city which is, you know, based on this one industry. There's a doco on a strike there I saw last year, and the workers were saying, oh, no, no, we never really had much to do with each other. Everyone had their own lives until this whole strike broke out. Even the village of Bilin in Palestine, you know, which is famous for having its weekly demonstrations against the wall, you can see a documentary about that, which everyone should, Bilin My Love, where they say, oh, no, we never really cooperated much before. You know, it's when the demonstration started, that's when we started coming together. And now look at us, we eat together, you know, we celebrate together, we keep each other strong and so on. So it can actually be the struggle that brings people together. Just because people aren't together now doesn't mean we can't have a struggle. Okay, there's other points that could be made, but I'll leave it there in terms of the general stuff and start to talk us through some of this history. And I guess the point that I'm going to try to make is that there is nothing inevitable about the sort of decline that we've seen in union strength in Australia. There's a whole series of key points where that could have been turned around, where, you know, there was a spontaneous sort of upsurge from the working class, and for various reasons, especially the role of the officials, that didn't turn into a serious fight back and a revival of the unions. This is a bit that could really blow out, so keep those notes on the time coming. Just to sort of talk people through some of the highs and lows. I should start by talking about 1969, because that's one of the, definitely one of the highs. This is the headline from Tribune, the Communist Party newspaper, on May the 21st, 1969. There's the actual copy that people can take a bit of a flick through, or whatever. This is one of the most famous strike waves in Australian history, and rightly so. The occasion was the jailing of Clary O'Shea, the Secretary of the Tramways and Bus Employees Union here in Melbourne, who refused to pay fines that had been levied on the union for industrial action on the buses. The previous maybe 15 years, unions had been seriously held in check by these things called the penal powers that were actually passed by the Labor government after World War II, enormously strengthened by the Menzies government, and they levied massive fines on unions that dared to take so-called unlawful strike action. It was in 1969 that, after, you know, quite a deal of preparation, quite a deal of build-up, a bunch of the left-wing unions, centred especially here in Melbourne, decided that it was time to, you know, bring these laws to a confrontation point and to take the system on. Clary O'Shea was brought to the court, was asked, are you prepared to pay the fines? He said no, and he said, well, will you hand over the bank account details of the union so that the money can be taken out? He said, no, I'm not authorised to do that by the members, and was sent by the judge to jail for contempt of court. This was the signal for a massive strike wave that started here in Melbourne, spread to New South Wales, to Queensland, and throughout the country. It was about a week that it went on, and close to 500,000 workers took action, and the momentum was really gathering. The response was the total backdown of the government. Clary O'Shea was released from jail because an ASIO sort of snitch ended up paying the fine, just get him out of jail, clear the contempt, you know, back off. And the result was an enormous explosion of industrial militancy. To move along a bit quicker. So 1969 is, I think it's that one actually, a sharp jump in industrial action. You get, industrial action, and from that time, in a way it was never the good old days. You can read Liz's really excellent book on the Builders Labourers Federation from the late 70s through. And, you know, they were a militant union. They were always being sued, always being threatened with deregistration, always in strife. But there was a space that workers and their unions used to really win some of the quite good working conditions and wages that much of the working class in Australia enjoyed in the 70s. So that wage militancy peaked in 1974. You had the onset of the recession in 75 that tamed it somewhat. But the really big decline comes in 1983 with the ACTU, the peak trade union body in Australia, signing off on the prices and incomes accord with the Hawke and Keating government. Thank you. Now, all of a sudden, to get a wage rise, you weren't to go out on strike and actually win it yourself from your boss or threaten to go out on strike. All of a sudden, wages were basically decided centrally by the government sitting down with the bosses and with the union body. And workers that went outside that system and demonstrated some sort of militancy, not just to, you know, accept the, what was actually an annual pay cut that we were dished out in the early years of the accord, workers that went outside that system and continued to fight, found their unions taken on individually and totally mercilessly smashed. The Southeast Queensland Electricity Board workers in 1985, the Builders Labourers Federation in 1986, Robe River Iron Ore Miners in 86, the pilots in 89, I think, and so on. And it was really the ACTU operating as the industrial police, you know, squashing down any attempt by workers to break out of that straitjacket of the accord. Okay. Now, there's plenty of, you know, potential turning points and all the rest of it in that, but time is on the wing, so I'll keep moving along to 1992. Now, sometimes you get a potential turning point in the class struggle when the bosses and their parties think they have us all stitched up and, you know, there's, you know, after the accord had been 10 years of relative labour peace, you know, networks of rank-and-file activists, of shop stewards and so on had greatly shrunk in size. The working class was a lot less combative. And after about 10 years of that, in 1992, Jeff Kennett came to power here in Victoria and decided that now was the time to really smash through. He was elected in October the 3rd, I think it was, 1992, and within a month he had announced the abolition of state awards that, you know, this was like a revolution for me. You can abolish awards. You know, these things have been around for the better part of a century and regulated the minimum conditions of many workers. Kennett just said, no, we'll scrap it. He announced the privatisation of basically every key utility, so the trams, the trains, the electricity, you know, water eventually and so on, were to be privatised. He was going to shut down 230 schools. He was going to sack 8,000 teachers. He was going to cut 30,000 from the public sector. And so on and so on and so on. It was like waking up every day to the radio and just getting a boot in the head with what he'd announced. This was the response on the 10th of November 1992. And this is the scene at the corner of Spring Street and Collins Street, the Paris end of Collins Street, as they call it, on the 10th of November 1992. And it was to that point, as far as I know, the biggest working class demonstration in Victoria's history. We had something like 150,000 people on the streets. We had 800,000 workers on strike. And, like, the bosses were really running for cover. One example of that, I mean, the Financial Review, you can't, you know, make things up as well, but they'd been mildly supportive of the Kennett so-called reforms up until that point. On the 11th of November 1992, they published an editorial that started, "A complete disaster is brewing in Victoria." Oh my God, you stirred them up and now look at this, you know, now what you're going to do? I was a shop steward at the time at a telephone exchange in Northcote. And, you know, everyone was in the union, but no one really gave a damn about it. Until this came along, and all of a sudden I had workmates I'd never really talked much with before coming up and gripping my arm and saying, "What we need to do, every worker in Australia needs to go out on strike until this bastard's finished." There was such a mood for continuing this sort of action. But it was not to be. The whole campaign was sold out. I mean, that's the thing, when workers move into action, you know, we look most of the time to our established leadership, which means the union leadership, to give some sort of a lead. The lead that the union leaders gave, John Halfpenny especially, the Secretary of Trades Hall, just down the road here, was very much keep your powder dry. Okay, we've had our one big day, maybe in 6 months we'll have another big strike, and then maybe 6 months later we'll have another big strike, and really not much is going to go on in between. And, like, I mean, the whole whatever you can call that a strategy, was a total failure. Kennett just steamrolled right through, didn't take any notice of these protests, really. 2 years after this giant protest, John Halfpenny, the Secretary of Tradshall, stumbled through something of an apology in an article in the Melbourne Age, and he said this. If we were given a rerun of the events, perhaps if we were given a second chance, we may have decided to go in much harder in the wake of the November 10 rally. We perhaps made the mistake in believing that the Kennett government was made up of normal human beings. And on that basis, like, you know, let's be nice to the normal human beings, he called off the action. Kennett didn't talk. The result was, entire working class communities, such as out in the Latrobe Valley, being totally gutted. The result was jobs with local councils that had previously been, you know, fairly comfortable, jobs for life. All of a sudden, you've got compulsory competitive tendering, and you've got to work like a slave and your job, you know, there's no job security. You have the privatisation and tax on working conditions in all of the state utilities and so on. We are still paying a huge price for that sellout. Okay. But I think it is a great example of even after a decade of relative Labor peace, you know, sometimes the ruling class can overstep the mark, get this sort of response, and that is our opportunity. Okay. As predicted, this is blowing out, so skipping along. The next potential turning point I want to talk about is in 1998. Just as, basically what Kennett had done in Victoria, John Howard, when, after Keating and Hawke had finally demoralised the last of the true believers and we booted them out in 1996, Howard wanted to go in for the kill, and especially to take on the centres of union militancy on the docks, in the meatworks, and in the construction industry. In fact, 12 years ago this weekend, just before Easter in 1998, 1,400 unionised waterfront workers, stevedores, working for Patrick Corporation, were sacked, and their jobs were taken by charming individuals such as this, who had been, a scab labour force who had been trained up, consisting largely of mercenaries, ex-soldiers and so on. They'd been trained up in Dubai, of all places, and then shipped back to Australia to try to run an operation without the powerful waterfront unions at all. So this was very much the scene in Easter 1998. But once again, the response was a lot more than the ruling class had bargained for. That was from, I think, The Age the next day. You don't get a really clear picture, but that's a bit of the scene of the crowd that gathered down at the docks in Melbourne. Here's the guards with dogs clearing the unionised workers off. Now, I don't have time to go into all of the detail of the dispute, but suffice to say, you could go down, for about a month, you could go down to the docks in Melbourne and to other places in Australia, this is the front page of the Herald Sun, and you could find literally thousands of people there from all walks of life. You talk to people working in a warehouse saying, yes, oh, there's 30 in the warehouse. We've got 3 down here at any one time and we keep a rotating shift going. In the evening, I think it was the NTU shift. So you'd meet a whole bunch of university workers and so on. And we succeeded in shutting down. This is a picture of picketers on the railway lines coming out of the Melbourne docks. And we succeeded in shutting down the Melbourne docks totally, Patrick's operation anyway, Sydney to a large extent and a lesser extent in some of the other ports. And the atmosphere was just electric. You know, everyone understood that this was a real key battle for our side. The officials were quite timid in their response. After a little bit of the mass picketing, there was a mass meeting at, I think it was at Dallas Brooks Hall. Lee Hubbard, who by that time was the Secretary of Tradesall Council, talked about the importance of keeping the pickets going, but we have to obey the law. Susie Latham, who was a socialist, a postal union delegate, got up and said, well, I'm for breaking the law. I'm for supporting these workers, even if it means breaking the law. Who here is in favour of breaking the law? Put up your hands! Put up your hands! And the entire room put up their hands with Lee Hubbard going like this. At the next meeting, about a couple of weeks later, it was Lee Hubbard urging people to put up their hands to break the law. You know, he was sort of, you know, racing to the left in order to catch up. But once again, it was a brilliant opportunity squandered. After a series of legal victories, you know, if you're winning on the docks, then you tend to win in the courts as well. After a series of legal victories, the waterfront workers were allowed to march back into their workplace. But they worked without pay for about 2 months, a hell of a lot of them without pay for about 2 months, while a whole series of legal machinations ensued, you know, the threats of individuals being sued, of deregistration and so on. This enormous pressure kept on the Maritime Union. The ports were working normally. There was no pressure on the ruling class at all to do anything other than, you know, to keep talking. At the end of the day, anyone who worked down on the docks can tell you that it was a disaster. Patrick's got every single thing that they wanted. Half the workforce got sacked. They introduced this thing, you know, one-person operation of the giant straddle cranes instead of two people, which meant that, you know, for 8 hours you're peering down a hole like this, a massive increase in chronic back complaints because of that, the outsourcing of a whole lot of core functions to non-unionised workplaces and so on. So once again, you know, a massive opportunity totally squandered by our officials. You could say the same thing about the upsurge over work choices in 2005, late 2005, and that was another time when, by this time I was in construction, another time when I had people coming up and literally grabbing my arm and saying, 20,000 people, we could shut this city down, you know, as soon as this becomes law, as soon as work choices becomes law, we've got to shut Melbourne down. And, it was a very popular sentiment, once again, channeled by the officials into, let's just have one pedestrian rally after another and so on. Okay, so the overall picture is pretty clear, and, you know, there's a pretty clear pattern that emerges. If a bunch of people do something once, you can say, oh, well, it's a mistake. If they do it a couple of times, you know, you can say maybe it's a bad policy. If they keep doing it, if the officials keep selling out struggle after struggle, year after year, decade after decade, well, you've got to say it's something structural. And the something structural is the position that union officials occupy within the system of capitalism. They don't work on the shop floor. They're not actually directly affected by the, you know, defeats or otherwise that workers experience. Their role basically is to get their shiny black shoes under the negotiating table and to strike a deal. That to sell that deal to their members, to work out with other unions, you know, what deals they're doing, to get those deals ratified by Fair Work Australia or whatever. At the end of the day, the whole point becomes make a deal. The actual struggle that wins the deal, well, that's sort of incidental, you know. But the whole point becomes make a deal. If you step one step back from that even, you know, union officials actually don't have an interest in the abolition of capitalism because, you know, their role as a sort of broker between capital and labour depends on their being capital. So, you know, though they, in practice, they vacillate, they move to the left, they move to the right, they can be pressured from below as well as from above, they can be made to fight and so on. At the end of the day, they're a fundamentally conservative social class and you can see that in their behaviour very clearly in Australia over the last 30-odd years. Okay. So, I was going to talk a little about what the ACTU has to offer in terms of a strategy. Liz has a really excellent article on the Socialist Alternative website at the moment, a review of Michael Crosby's book from a couple of years ago, I think. Michael Crosby used to be the head of the organising centre at the ACTU. And they've moved away from a lot of the rhetoric of the Accord. They say, oh, well, that was like a service model of unionism where the members are passive and we just service them as officials. Now we want an active membership. We want an organising strategy, they call it. But they've changed the title without changing the content. And the content is class collaboration. And there's, you know, there's things that we could say about that, but I'll have to keep moving along. So to pull out some general points of what a strategy might look like. Obviously, we are for class struggle, not for class collaboration. It was class collaboration that got us into this mess in the first place through the Accord, you know, and so on. You know, we are not for any of this nonsense about making Australia more competitive. We believe that bosses and workers have totally opposite interests and that actually it's the struggle of the workers that can drive things forward, not collaboration. Further than that, you know, you have a much more effective struggle if the rank and file is mobilised to the maximum extent. So one of the Communist Party slogans from Australia in the 1930s was make every member an activist. And that's something that I often bear in mind going about my daily union work or whatever. You know, that has to be the strategy, to mobilise the maximum number of people, you know, as much as you can at the time. Our approach to the officials has to be totally critical. We have to see that they don't share our interests and that they will be extremely prepared to sell us out. We want to use the action that they call, but we want to use that to increase the self-confidence and organisation of the rank and file, not to just leave it in the hands of the officials. Another point is keeping it political, because in any struggle with the officials, the officials have a set of politics. They have a very worked out and coherent set of reformist politics, you know, which they use to sell out every struggle. And in order to challenge those officials, you know, I mean, the officials could be pushed around and pushed to the left and run to the left and so on, but to actually consistently challenge them, you know, day in, day out, down on a picket line, in an industrial dispute, let alone year after year after year, you really, really helps to have a set of politics which is clear as well, that explains why these bastards keep selling out, that explains that, you know, the key is struggle and so on. In order to take on the, you know, the strategy of the officials, we need a different strategy. And underlying that strategy of rank and file democracy and so on is a different set of politics from the officials, is revolutionary politics. And there are many, many examples of in history. And again, tomorrow there's a talk about the Teamsters Rebellion in the 30s in the US, about the Communist Party leading the revival of the unions here in the 30s, where you know, communist parties and groups of revolutionary socialists have been absolutely central to rebuilding unions. So, you know, it's really important to keep it political, not just to, you know, whether it's in work or in general, not just to talk about, you know, the most immediate industrial sort of issues. And finally, I guess it's important to look for the opportunities and to realise that a lot of those opportunities will actually be really small ones that we're dealing with. You know, there's not going to be an MUA dispute every year, but, you know, if you're political where you are, if you're active where you are, you're constantly trying to look for the things that people are pissed off about, that you can organise a bit about, that you can get a bit of movement out of the union about, and so on. And if we're not looking all the time for those small opportunities, we're not going to be ready to take the much larger ones as well. So how all of those, you know, very general points translates into a specific situation, you know, varies enormously, and just looking around the room, you know, the workplace situations of just some of the people that I know, you know, are really diverse. You know, I'm in very heavily unionised construction industry, other people are working in call centres, other people are working in hardware stores. You know, there's no one, you know, sort of easy 5-point action plan that we can just wheel out to say what's appropriate in all of these circumstances. So in the discussion, we should probably have some discussion about, you know, like what people have done in the workplace, what you know, as well as the general sort of picture of the officials and the history and so on, what you know, what's going on in different people's workplace, what is useful and so on. I guess one of the sort of default strategies for, you know, a long time for the left in the unions was to try to set up some sort of rank and file group. Even this to me doesn't seem particularly appropriate at the moment. With class struggle at such a low ebb, you know, and class politics at a pretty low ebb, it's not like there's all these people, or indeed, you know, handfuls of people that we can easily find to involve in meaningful activity in some sort of rank and file group. Okay. I was going to finish with a few notes about construction, which is where I work. And that's a bit difficult because I can talk for a hell of a long time about that. But I'll talk for a couple of minutes. The construction union has taken some enormous steps backward over the last 5 years since we've had the Australian Building and Construction Commission. You know, one way of illustrating that is our approach to health and safety. When I first started on sites, if there was a serious safety incident on a building site, the whole site would stop. Whether you're working in that area or somewhere totally different, the whole site would stop. You'd all sit in the sheds while the safety committee investigated. That might take a couple of hours. Then they'd report back to you, and it would be up to the members. Someone might move a motion saying, well, you know, stuff these bastards. You know, we've got to teach them to take safety seriously. Let's cost them a day's production, and everyone would walk. And, you know, like, yeah, that was the way it was. Since the ABCC was introduced, all of a sudden the union officials are totally petrified of being sued out of existence. And so unlawful industrial action is the thing that the ABCC targets. Unlawful industrial action is basically stopping work for any reason. So now the most serious safety incidents can happen on a site, and I don't hear until, you know, lunchtime, you know, 3 hours later or whatever. It's all rumour and so on. And as a pretty direct result of that, like there's been a sharp increase, and this is not just me saying it, you know, WorkCover statistics and even an ILO investigation now bears it out. There's been an extremely sharp increase in the number of workers hospitalised and even killed on Australian construction sites. We had 1 year in 2005 where for the first time in history we had 12 months without a worker being killed in commercial construction in Victoria. At the end of 2005 the ABCC was introduced, and since then we have not had, like, you know, you can see the graph, the unions done the figures, and the number of workers being killed. Now the thing with taking it on, I mean, yeah, it's very hard for me as an individual, you know, you try to push it as much where you can, but like, the construction union is one place where the officials are extremely entrenched. There's really often not much space that, you know, like I can push so far, but then it's, well, what does the union say? And if the union doesn't say we can stop, well, we don't have any backing, so we can't really stop. And that's pretty much where it ended. One of the things that has come up in over the last year, at the start of last year, there was a couple of very sharp battles in construction. The downturn was hitting fairly hard. A couple of the employers decided to try it on. And one of the disputes was at the Westgate Bridge. And without going through all of the ins and outs of it, in order to establish their presence on the job and get the boss to even talk to them, the CFMEU had to call out, like, you know, do it pretty old school, just shut down construction sites across the city, march people down to the Westgate Bridge and shut down that site for the day. Now, that was enough to sort of, you know, oh, my God, horrify the bosses. Things have picked up a little bit since then and there haven't been all these sort of confrontations. As a result of that action, though, the ABCC went to the federal court wanting $8 million in fines levied against the union. The union sat down in a court-appointed mediation session and said, well, we don't think we did that much, da, 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 da. And eventually the figure that's been reached is $1 million. And it's three branch meetings now in a row that I've been to of the Victorian CFMEU where someone, either myself or someone else, has got up and said, excuse me, we're giving $1 million to these bastards? I thought we were meant to be fighting them. And the response comes back from Billy Oliver, who's nowadays the secretary, saying, well, it's not like Larry O'Shea days, you know. There's these little things called computers, and the banks have them, and our money's on them, and if we don't hand over the money, they'll just bloody take it anyway, and better to pay $1 million, like, that's a bit of, you know, bark off the tree. $8 million would kill us. You want to see the end of the union, do you? And that was the response, the first time it was raised. The third time it was raised, just a couple of weeks ago, the response was, like, a little bit similar. We can't avoid paying the fine, you know, whatever. Better to pay $1 million than $8 million. But, well, you know, really, and this is, again, Billy Oliver, who's no left-winger talking, we need to take them on at some point. And that point will probably be when an individual, you know, has taken some sort of action and is dragged in front of the ABCC, that, you know, we can rally the troops around that. It's probably going to be on some sort of safety issue. And, you know, and that day is coming perhaps sooner than what we might think, says Billy Oliver. The case that people may have heard of is Ark Tribe. Who's a South Australian construction worker who's going back to court in June. He refused to attend an interview with the ABCC about a health and safety meeting that was held at his work site. And for that, he's facing the possibility of 6 months jail. When he goes to court in June, there'll be stoppages around the country and rallies in support. If he goes to jail, and I don't think the bosses really want him jailed, because if he goes to jail, there will be national industrial action in response to that. But that sort of puts it off a bit in the never-never, you know. If this happens, then we take action. It's all the bit, yeah. And I've been at a little bit of a loss, you know. I've tried a couple of different things, but I've been at a little bit of a loss to say, okay, here's the sort of way to steer through it, you know. Here's what we should be saying. There's anything much different to Billy Oliver. The other thing worth mentioning in terms of construction, like, the Victorian branch is the most militant branch. They've been waiting for the rest of the country to sort of say, yes, we'll join you in a campaign. I think the frustration is now growing amongst the Victorian officials, and I heard last week on their weekly radio show on 3CR, 9:30 on a Sunday morning, that they have actually called what sounds like it will be a statewide stoppage on the 28th of April, which is International Workers' Memorial Day, to talk about health and safety on the job and the effect that the ABCC has had on that. So it's far from this sort of, you know, militant, all-out defiance that's the image that the union wants to sort of portray. It's not total back-down either. And, you know, this is some of the difficulties that I've faced in trying to navigate exactly how far to push and what I should be pushing and so on. Anyway, that's me. There'll be other people with different experiences, so I should just sit down and throw it open to discussion.